Today is August 20th, 1997. The speaker is Dwayne Addison. The topic is Hosea, Prophet of Steadfast Love.
Lord, we thank you for your servant Hosea, who leads us into our hearts and to your heart. Help us to hear the pain, the compassion, the joy that comes from one who deeply loves you and is compelled to share this love with all those around him. In Jesus' name, amen. Around the air, I'm Dwayne Addison, a longtime teacher of Bible and many other things, including ethics and world religions and Native American studies at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Semi-retired, now teaching some of these things at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. Biblical prophets for today, I think they are very powerful and very relevant, very exciting. I have a passion for the prophets that I explained the other day. Today, the passion is for Hosea, the prophet of passionate love, or the prophet of steadfast love. And I say it is not only passionate love, but love that hangs on and sticks through and doesn't let go. We have that hymn. That is an allusion also to the language of Hosea. And this is the setting of what we have today, Wednesday the 20th. I'm going to talk about our agenda, just a bit about the setting. We'll take a look at chapter 2, some passages, 2 verses 14 to 20. We'll talk about the prophet as a person as much as we can. To take a look at chapter 4, the opening things where the message proper begins in Hosea when he speaks that God has a controversy with his partner Israel. And Hosea takes God's side of the thing. He is not an advocate for the people. He is the advocate for God in this sort of controversy. And then we will look at the key passage, chapter 6, verses 1 to 6. And at the end, with every prophet, I've selected out a passage or a verse even that sort of gets to the heart of the passage. This one is Hosea 6 to 6. And keep that in mind because we will allude, I hope, and remind me to turn to Matthew 9 and Matthew 12, where Jesus puts this in context. If you go and read this, or if you had known what this means, then you would not have acted that way. And so I'll talk about the connection perhaps with Jesus, but a century and a half later, another prophet called Jeremiah down in Judah, and take these themes and build them more deeply and more powerfully and more subtly. But here's the man who introduced some of these powerful themes that we take as part of the Christian gospel. Many commentators would say, this is the gospel of the Old Testament, or the beginnings of the gospel in terms of its style and its themes, in terms of the understanding of God. And Heschel says, the great value of Hosea is that it gives us insight into God. And we learn from Hosea the inwardness or the heart of God. And I hope you can sort of feel and understand that along the way. But the setting. Yesterday we looked at Amos, that ranting and raving prophet, that farmer and goat herder from the desert who comes down to the plush area of the prosperous Israel, to the city of Bethel, where the great shrine of the king is. Sometime after the fall of the great empire of Solomon, the great kingdom. It had been divided as soon as Solomon died, but now the northern kingdom, the great bulk of the people, had become prosperous under Jeroboam the Great. Amos was doing his thing somewhere in between 760 and 750 before the Christian era. A time of wealth and prosperity and a sense of security and confidence. The people thought the day of the Lord was coming and everything was going to be perfect here and what God had promised was going to take place upon the earth. And Amos came and said, no way. The day of the Lord that you long for is darkness, not light. Your nation is going down into destruction and exile. Beginning less than a decade later, and we know of no obvious personal connection between Amos, who is the outsider, and Hosea, who is a native son. There's some themes that they share in common, and we don't know how they would connect. But the external situation has changed radically. The nation is filled with chaos. the stock market has crashed, we might say. Corruption is everywhere. There is despair and fear. And the big news of the day is that huge empire on the east called Assyria, now on the rise, and people know about it. And the phrase in the Bible is, bloody Assyria. It had a bloody god named Ashur. When they conquered their people, they enjoyed tearing them apart. And they had the policy very early to come in to conquer people, to assure there would be no rebellion there. And the little nations of the world were sort of a practice ground for their fighting against Egypt. They'd come and they would sort of take the people, destroy their leaders and the cream of their crop, and then take the people and scatter them over their far-ranging empire. We have the phrase, you know, the 10 lost tribes of Israel. I mean, the 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel lived in what we call Samaria, or the Northern Kingdom, or sometimes referred to simply as Israel by their own terminology on that. And, you know, at the end, or near the end of Hosea's life, it is simply gone. It is down the drain. And the people that were Samaria, or Israel here, are now scattered over the face of the western part of the Asian continent. There are no 10 tribes of Israel. And that we'll be looking at later, because Jerusalem was almost destroyed but miraculously saved, you know, during a little bit later than this time as well. But Assyria. If you've ever been to Israel and know the geography of it, Samaria, or what we call Northern Kingdom here, is one of the great crossroads of the world. That's for good or evil, and God simply planted his people, God's people, on that place. It is a crossroad. This is Times Square. Because, you know, the armies and the commerce from Egypt, that great civilization, would have to pass through here to the Mesopotamian Valley, or to go up into Asia Minor, and therefore into what we would be, you know, developed as Europe on that. And so there were a series of crossroads that crossed in this area. And so, you know, if you were living there, like we had the planes flying over yesterday, you know, the armies, you know, look out today, which army is going by now? And there are dozens of them, but all of a sudden, the great empires, which were a long ways away, in northern Mesopotamian Valley, or in some parts in the Nile Valley on there, they were fighting over the territory, and they fought their battles. You know, in the Bible we speak about Armageddon. And my wife and I are in Israel a couple of years ago, and we went to the fortress Megiddo. And there's sort of a natural pass there that you can take your commerce, your nowadays, this is where the trucks go, and where the chariots can go, and your horses and armies can go. And so if you're going north, and you're going to be conquering, or if you're retreating, you go by Megiddo. And so probably hundreds of great battles were fought near that pass of Megiddo. And if you look there, you look down on that lush plain of Jezreel, that valley, that most of Judah is practically desert. It is rock, and you don't know how people survive that except raising goats like Amos did. And you look down there, and you see these beautiful fields, you know, and of course, Jesus' story, then the Sea of Galilee are also within that territory as well. But here, the thing I just want to lay out, the time of chaos, the threat of the Syrian Empire, but we'll see with Hosea here, the problems were not out there. The problems were here. And the problems were in the relationship that we have with the one who has covenanted with us to be our partner. Turn to chapter 2, verses 14 to 20. And just to note, the key phrase, term that Hosea would use for the people and the nation would be Ephraim. Ephraim is one of the sons of Joseph. And so the name of the tribe is Ephraim, and he uses it poetically and affectionately for his people. And that's so his term, and the most common way of doing it. Who has it handy? And just indicate the translation that you have, the version, and then we'll listen to chapter 2, verses 14 to 20. Okay?
This is the New Revised Standard.
Okay.
Therefore I will now allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. From there I will give her her vineyards and make the valley of Achor a door of hope. There she shall respond as in the days of her youth, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. On that day, says the Lord, you will call me my husband, and no longer will you call me my Baal. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be mentioned by name no more. I will make for you a covenant on that day with the wild animals, the birds of the air, and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land. And I will make you lie down in safety. And I will take you for my wife forever. I will take you for my wife in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and in mercy. I will take you for my wife in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord.
The Baals or the Baals are the pagan gods. They are the lords of the land. The religion that surrounds here and then filtered it into the Hebrew faith is a fertility religion. The term Baal or Baal, and I'll use the Baal on that, is a simply term that means lord, or it could mean husband. And that type of many nature religions, or fertility religions we could call them, the crops grew here, and you had good crops and good rains in the time because you did the proper sort of religious actions to do it. And the primary form of action by worshiping God was prostitution. And so the big business of worship here was these prostitutes that sort of really were symbolically interacting with their husband, Baal. And we'll see this when we get the story of Hosea and his wife. That becomes a part of that story as well. And so they have left Yahweh. They've gone after Baal, another husband. And the language we have here is a language of wooing, of calling Israel back, forgiving, restoring the relationship that Yahweh, the Lord, says is fruitless. And I will be you, you will call me your husband once more. But what do you hear from these words, or even questions about the text? Because there's much in Hosea that is really difficult. And it is the Lord speaking. And most of Hosea, by the way, is text in terms of I. And I look at all the books of the Bible. It would come in English translation, the word me is there most often. And it refers to God, subjectively. But what do you hear? Phrases, images. And it left at the end, and I still invite you to that very end again. I will betroth you to me forever. A language of engagement that we would have in our time. And that's very important in the language and marriage custom. Oh, betrothed you in righteousness and justice. The phrase of Amos when the cardinal sort of runs there. And steadfast love, which we'll explore a bit later because it's the key theme, I think, of Hosea. And in mercy, which is another term, that are used parallel here. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. Again, I have that up there because knowing the Lord is going to be at the heart also of the theology or the insights of Hosea.
Right. I was just surprised that I hadn't heard this in any marriage ceremonies. It seemed like the kind of thing that you'd say when you were getting married. Mm-hmm. It's a promise.
A promise.
And it's also a vision. Mm-hmm. A good life that includes a faith in another, namely the Lord, mm-hmm. that isn't exclusively us two.
Yeah. You haven't heard, I believe they've been sort of changed and watered down, but I cannot conceive of the marriage vows, at least the more traditional ones, without Hosea, because one of the things Hosea does is to take the idea of covenant, of God's partnership, and put it in terms of human marriage. Jeremiah will take it and develop it even more, but this is the first place I know in the Bible in which God's relation to human beings is described here in terms of marriage. A little later, it is going to be talked about, which is not new to him, in terms of parent and child as well. But both of them have the possibility of feeling the pain and the passion and the love and the other themes that Hosea deals with. Yeah. And yes.
Could you explain? This almost seems like prophetic, or and yet in reality, this doesn't happen, does it? I mean, these people are soon going to be destroyed. They're going to be wiped out, lost forever. So it seems strange language here that speaks so positively of the future.
Yeah.
And for them, as my understanding is, it doesn't happen.
I hinted the session there, and I was going to come back. I'll come back to this again. I always in my classes and the sessions that I have in Hosea that there is very little prediction in Hosea, and the one primary prediction that he has doesn't come true. At least my Jewish friends tell me that. And Heschel, you know, Abraham Heschel, the Jewish rabbi, wrestles that as well. I'll never let you go. And the Jewish people begin counting here. Okay, yeah, you let us go then, and then, and then, and then way back in that time, you know, about the time that Hosea dies, we don't know when, you know, the nation is let go. What does this mean? And Heschel begins, I don't know if it's a satisfactory answer, but I think it is a very painful answer that the promises of God can be proven wrong. The compassion of God cannot. And what we have here is the intent and the compassion of God. But if you take this as prediction, you know, and a lot of people say that, you know, the prophets are prediction. If you take Hosea as prediction, Hosea strikes out. If you look at history at the time and history since, and testimony not only the Jewish experience, but temporary the Jewish experience on that, you know, I will not let you go. And from the human side, boy, God, let us go. And that is really a troubling thing that we have to wrestle with theologically. And I talked with somebody yesterday about the Holocaust. That whole experience in which God was silent and God failed us. And they have known the promises and the stories and the deliverances of God in the past, and the story of God delivering from Egypt is what made Israel. And when the crunch came in our time and we waited for God and we knew God to be compassionate and forgiving and steadfast, God was silent.
But is our time the same as God's time?
That's true. I don't know. That's one way of doing that. And we can also look at the story of Jesus. You know, that...
Hope must have been real strong, man.
What?
Hope.
Yeah, I mean, this is the theme we're going to be dealing with. It comes so powerfully in Hosea because our tradition is to see the prophets as sort of predicting the future, and it's almost sort of certain. And you hear the Bible thumpers on the radio, they'll talk about that and said, do these guys ever read Hosea? And to wrestle with the people here who have trusted in those promises. And I'm just sort of asking here, if you take Hosea seriously as a part of the Word of God, that you know, we can hang on to that sort of love and compassion and know and trust that that is real and have hope based in that sort of steadfast love of God. Mm-hmm. But to realize that God has been silent too many times. And that's not only the Jewish experience, but they have known that as a community. So I think that's, I mean, it raises, the scholars that deal with Hosea, it's filled with all sorts of textual and language difficulties we don't have to deal with. It's a very complicated book. But his message, I think, is so utterly simple. But even in that simple message here, it really leaves that whole question. If God's love is so powerful and sustaining, why the failure of the prophecy? Yes?
Well, isn't there, though, this was a long time ago, and to the extent that Hosea was speaking to the people of Israel, I mean, I guess you could take a forward view and say, okay, well, you know, in 1947, part of this came true, and, and perhaps by 2047, another chapter will come through.
Yeah, this is another way of, you know, there are various ways that community and theology being raised of dealing with it. We have that in the New Testament. You know, it appeared to Jesus, people heard Jesus that he was going to come back in their own lifetime. And he did not come back in the way that he expected. And so you have to deal with this. And that's similar to the situation in Hosea, that God would not let you go. And Hosea, about the time he dies here, it's gone. I mean, there's almost nobody there to tell the story anymore. You only have memories. And so the southern kingdom was shuddering in its boots here because they were much less powerful than that. And so if God loves Ephraim, but Ephraim is wiped out. And that's an issue, because I'm going to be celebrating the inwardness and the passion of God. But we cannot remain silent ourselves and pick up, the question I was conversing yesterday. To understand why it is difficult to be a believing Jew when 6 million or more of your people that have taken the name of Yahweh have been wiped out, and half of those are children. And the writers say, Christians too, because it's the same God that we worship. And Christians ought to do it too, because they were primary participants in the carrying out of that sort of thing. But the greatest concern is with the silence of God. I don't know if any of you read any of the novels and materials of Elie Wiesel, who all of his body of work sort of struggled with this. He goes back to the biblical figures and struggles with it. He troubles it, as his own in night in terms of the experience of himself as a child, and he does it in novel sorts of forms. And, he says, we cannot forget. He has passed through the crisis. He is an active believer and practicer of the Jewish faith, but a very chastened view. And many Jewish people cannot in integrity trust God anymore because of what has happened.
Could you not argue that God was silent because we were silent?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the part of the answer here, that God's silence is the part of the human silence. And I think this puts a special sort of question towards Christians. Here in the heart of the great Lutheran nation of the Reformation is where this, the modern Holocaust took its shape on that. And it took its devastating form in Eastern Europe under Eastern that. And all brands of Christianity were caught up in that. And so it was not only our silence, but our complicity. And I think, that's the direction I moved here, because I finally cannot personally answer the question on behalf of God. I can do a little bit to answer it in behalf of ourselves. But that is the toughest theological question of all. About how do you understand? And particularly after you've read Hosea, and I think you've caught it right as a source here, if God is so compassionate and loving, like the lover who wants his wife back even though she's been unfaithful, the parent who wants his child back even though they've been rebellious on that, and then the story tells us that the lover and the parent did not deliver. And so I can celebrate the passionate love of God, but somehow I have to put that up against the reality of the events then and the events ever since. Yes?
This is an interesting picture of God, though, in that he's doing all the work.
Yeah.
He doesn't say, if you do this, I will do this. It's just, I will pursue you. I will hold you. I will be faithful and righteous.
That's very interesting insight, and that's very true. It is so much, I said, that he puts in the language of controversy as he begins the prophecy itself in the form here. And he takes here, not the advocate of the people, the defense lawyer, like many prophets do, but he is speaking on behalf of God. I will do this. I will do the judging. I will be doing the loving. And it's a very God-centered view, and Heschel reminds us it's sort of God from the inside in terms of God's feelings. And I indicated that the term me, if it's translated into English, is all over the place, because it's sort of, it's what God feels. It's God's pain, it's God's passion, and so forth. And so I don't know if I can ever get beyond Heschel, because he has to wrestle with that, because he dedicates his book to his family and his friends who died in the Holocaust. And then here, you get to celebrate a God of the prophets, who has declared that his love is so great and so passionate that he will not let you go. And that's the language of Hosea. And then, what do we make of that? How do we be faithful, biblical people in the face of both the text and of reality?
Isn't that the crucifixion?
It, This would be a whole other course, because I think the whole question of the crucifixion, I think, you know, is related to this.
Without the crucifixion, we are abandoned by God.
Yeah.
But the crucifixion is what allows us to have a God who goes through it with us,
mm-hmm.
who's been there and is there.
Yeah.
And it's not like, I mean, my reading of this particular piece is not that he's promising this woman a lavish lifestyle.
No, I think read it carefully
a
then.
That she's or safety and comfort until she dies. It's just that there will be the love will be there continuously, and that the caring will be there, and the commitment to create a better life is always there.
Mm-hmm.
That is there, but that it's a companion, not a welfare system.
It's not an easy question, because Jeremiah does this even better, but both Isaiah and Jeremiah, you know, open one to really to appreciate what we call in Lutherans the theology of the cross, what that means, and what the connections to the New Testament are so powerful in Hosea, and the same theological tough questions that we face in the Christian community, or we ought to face, unless you have a theology of triumph and glory, would also be here. And so I think Christians ought to live with the themes of Hosea here and the great questions on that, as well as the positive themes. I mean, let me end with that before I just sort of take it a bit further. You know, these themes are sort of cited at the end. I'll be chosen to me in righteousness and justice and steadfast love, and I'll be chosen to me in faithfulness, you know, and you shall know the Lord. An invitation. This is the language of wooing, not of compulsion, and at the surface level, not that of judgment. The person, we've already put here, and I've not had a chance to do the reading, because in chapter 2 and 3, there's some confusing passages, they're not quite sure, but the general way of putting the story here, and sort of the roots out of which the prophecy comes. Hosea has either married, or he has married a woman who became a prostitute, and probably, and I'm persuaded by this, a temple prostitute in the cult or the religion of Baal, in which prostitution is the central form of symbolic worship that is sort of there. And so he had married her with passion and love, like any young lover would in their youth, and apparently by the illusions that are there, that she responded in kind in those early years. But she bore him 3 children. 2 sons and a daughter, and the references there indicate that these were not his children. And so there's probably even more than temple prostitution, there's simply unfaithfulness in spades, as we would sort of say on that. And so Hosea is essentially looking humanly at this as the dumped lover. I joked here that when I taught this course at Augustana, and I always have the students do a research or a creative piece in the paper and some opics, and about half the girls, I mean, this is a class that's mostly juniors and seniors, and about half the girls in the class choose to write papers or essays or reflections upon Hosea. Because this is the biblical book of the prophets that speaks to them, you know, by the age of 19 or 20 or 21, they have known what it is to be in love and to be dumped. And if I were doing this to adult class, they would probably check on the chapter 11. They would know what it is to be a parent and to be disappointed in a child that has not sort of returned that love and affection, or has rebelled on that. And so it speaks to that deep human experience. Again, he is a native son, unlike Amos, who is the outsider that comes in. There's no obvious reference or connection to Amos, even though he speaks about justice and righteousness. And so the important thing to know about Hosea is that experience of disappointed love. And the illusions are all over the place. I mean, it's like, she's like dew, like morning rain, the cloud that passes over. I mean, over here, you know, that, I mean, you're talking about this, somebody, but boy, we had it great when we were young. That passionate love and that affection were there, but now she's ran after others. And that is the situation. And the very obvious thing, the insight comes God's relationship to Ephraim, or Israel, is very much like that. God has pursued and betrothed and provided these dowry for the wedding. And the woman, I'm sorry, this image is a very male sexist one. It's set in the language of marriage of the time. The one about the parent and the end, maybe a very feminist image, I think, about the parent and the child. And so he feels the pain. And God feels the pain of his betrothed. He was married to Israel. The talk about the covenant here is not simply an agreement or a bargain or a contract. This is the marriage thing, but vows. And vows that are rooted in deep passions of the heart and of the body, I would suggest. And then she goes away. And then the heart of it is put in two different forms here, but the typical way, chapter 3 begins. God comes along, and at least Hosea hears that. She's cheated on you. She's had three illegitimate children. She's gone after these things. She's not around. She's not a parent. She's not a wife. Take her back. Scholars, pious people have trouble with this. Why would God commit, you know, so many people to marry a prostitute? And they don't do it, and God wouldn't command anything like this. But that Hosea, I think, says that very clearly. To woo her once again, to welcome her back, to restore the passion that was once there, and to have a lasting relationship. And he does it. Because of this, Heschel says, Hosea, like no other prophet before him, he's able to feel himself into the pain and the heart and the passion of God. God has betrothed himself to God's people. And God's people have been unfaithful. But God wants her back. And will stoop so low, he will forgive, he will heal. I mean, the language of healing is another whole dimension there that we'll only have a chance perhaps to touch on there. And so that's the situation out of which it comes. Turn to chapter 4. Another set of images that I think are helpful to seeing. Would somebody like to read 4:1-6?
Hear the word of the Lord, O people of Israel, for the Lord has an indictment against the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or loyalty, and no knowledge of God in the land. Swearing, lying, and murder, and stealing and adultery break out. Bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore the land mourns, and all who live in it languish, together with the wild animals and the birds of the air, even the fish of the sea are perishing. Yet let no one contend, and let none accuse, for with you is my contention, O priest. You shall stumble by day, the prophet also shall stumble with you by night, and I will destroy your mother. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, because you have rejected knowledge. I reject you from being a priest to me. And since you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children.
Couple of just points that I'm asking for your sort of things. The term kindness, in my translation of the RSV, it says controversy, but it's the idea of a trial sort of setting. The term kindness is the word hesed that we'll be talking about in a moment. And to point out, there are a number of allusions to nature. God is deeply related to nature, and because of their failure, nature itself is being destroyed. And there's real sensitivity to the connection to human failure and nature in Hosea, and that's a whole other dimension we take. And then chapter 6, verse 6 is the key one, but let me hear you first and then we'll zero in on that one. What do you hear in this controversy or this set of indictments that is brought before a court? What are the charges?
Swearing, lying, murder, stealing, adultery.
Wow.
It's a breaking all the Ten Commandments.
They're doing it their style. Yeah. This is what he sees. Now it is wide open. a decade before Amos, you know, that he saw this below the surface. And now, you know, that which is sort of hidden now is on the, you know, upon the streets of Samaria.
Well, he also seems to be putting himself out of a job as a prophet in verse 4.
Oh, typically the prophets are, you know, their biggest complaint is against people called prophets.
I know, they're all.
But these prophets have sort of, they have failed. The priest has failed, the prophet has failed. Right. And so his indictment is against, you know, he doesn't speak about the king much, but he speaks about the priest and the prophet. These are the conveyors of the tradition, and they've been bought off. I mean, they are silent. We got this sort of thing about the silent.
But what does that say? Maybe I'm just missing something here, but in chapter, or in verse 4. Yet let no one, I mean, everything's falling apart, all the commandments, everything's being broken. Let no one contend and let none accuse, for with you is my contention, O priest. Is that basic? Who's the priest here?
Oh, the priest is the one who was part of the religious establishment. I mean, like we had an Amos here. Because the indictment is primarily against the priest and the prophet. I don't know if Hosea even calls himself a prophet. I'm trying to remember that sort of thing. But, you know, this is the primary sort of thing. And if you look at this carefully, he almost totally takes God's side. I mean, this is a kangaroo court. I mean, God calls the court and God gives the indictment and no defense for Israel on that. And very clearly, Heschel knows out that Hosea takes God's side in the controversy and is rare among the prophets because he does not defend the people. He loves the people. They are my people. But he does not usually defend them. Chapter 6 is one of those key passages you could rank with 6-6. My people. When you turn the term my people, it is almost always a reference to covenant. And there's always an old God phrase here, are destroyed for lack of knowledge. I want to come back to that when we talk about the message. Because you have rejected knowledge, I reject you from being a priest to me. The nation is the priest. This is an ancient idea from the book of Exodus that's along there, that the nation is the priest, and so it is more than just sort of the figure in the religious establishment. Since you have forgotten the law of God, I will also forget your children. Now, that is a prophecy, too. It's going to be countermanded that I won't forget. How can I forget? We'll come to that in just a moment here. But the problem of Israel or Ephraim, they have forgotten. Not only with the head, but they've forgotten with the heart. You no longer have that intimate knowledge of the Lord that once you had, maybe not so much personally, but as a people. And the illusions, typical among the prophets, that to the days of the wilderness, honeymoon. You know, I can't talk about wilderness as honeymoon, but the prophets so often speak about that time of wandering in the wilderness, which was not hunky-dory, by the way, if we read the book of Numbers on that, and Exodus at that point. But that was sort of a honeymoon in which Israel was close to God, close to the Lord. Now that they've moved out of the land here, and the situation is permanently, they have forgotten. The love has grown cold. Along the way, I'll speak here. What is the sin of Israel, of God's people? Amos, it's injustice, unrighteousness. It's how you treat the little people that are there. And somebody who commented in our last session, for Hosea, he goes to the roots of why there's that injustice and that unrighteousness. It is a matter not of actions, it is a matter of the heart. Or we'll see here, the problem, the sin that is century is apostasy. You have gone away, you have forgotten. Or the other side of that is idolatry. You no longer really worship God, but you worship someone else. Similar to the language of the unfaithful partner in marriage. Turn to chapter 6. That is the key passage, and I want to end with 6-6, which is sort of the heart of heart, perhaps, of Hosea's message. Who has that handy? I'm not sure.
For I desire steadfast love.
Why don't you start with 6:1 and then we'll climax with 6.
One through six?
6:1 through 6, yeah, the whole piece, yeah.
Come, let us return to the Lord. For it is he who has torn and he will heal us. He has struck us down and he will bind us up. After 2 days he will revive us. On the 3rd day he will raise us up, that we may live before him. Let us know, let us press on to know the Lord. His appearing is as sure as the dawn. He will come to us like the showers, like the spring rains and the water that water the earth.
And then this part becomes the passion part. Go ahead.
What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? Your love is like the morning cloud, like the dew that passes away early. Therefore I have hewn them by the prophets. I have killed them by the words of my mouth, and my judgment goes forth as the light. For I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings.
Again, what do you hear? What rings in your experience and feelings? Healing, invitation to know, to become intimate in the language.
Well, he's very strong in always repeating his desire for us to come to him, yeah, to love him, to know him, to want him.
It's phrased in terms of a question. When Amos used questions, they were rhetorical questions. They were sort of style. But this is the real question. What shall I do with you, Ephraim? Somebody painted a relationship. Deeply hurt. What am I to do? I don't know. I mean, people would be very nervous here talking about God. God doesn't know what to do. God knows everything. And here God says, what am I to do with the people that he has known intimately? And I think that is a real question cast before Hosea. Because he has experienced, what is he to do with Gomer? He knows and feels that God is required to take it back. And Gomer does not respond very well. I understand. What am I to do? I've done these things, you know, that the counselors have advised me to do. And, you know, like that morning cloud, you're like the dew, and that sort of thing. That, boy, she was a lover, but, you know, that was way back then. And, you know, she sort of whimsy, she went off after. She's, and some people say they're sort of compulsively unfaithful. I mean, that's her whole lifestyle is to, you know, to love and leave. And the leaving is the important part. You can love and leave again. And Gomer and Israel are like that. And the heart of the message. What I desire, it speaks about God's desire. I mean, this is not the typical theological language he talked about. I desire steadfast love, not sacrifice. Here, that's close to Amos. I mean, the sacrifice is a part of worship, but I think this is an allusion also to the Baal worship that is sort of there. The knowledge of God rather than burnt offering. And so that similarity with Amos, but with a much more passionate inward sort of thing. Other questions on that passage? Chapter 6, verse 6. Go ahead. You're going to go ahead.
Well, he does certainly presage Jesus coming in, in verse 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
With the two
days. That fascinating reference, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And then, and he does own that he's been,
yeah, I killed them in your translation. Mine, you know, I've hewn them. I mean, I've chopped them up over thy prophets.
I've killed them by the words of my mouth.
And the words of my mouth, yeah. And the prophets and the words here of do it. And I mean, you have chastised them in faith. Heschel, by the way, has one of the most powerful chapters in all theological literature on chastisement, on the meaning of punishment, and the futility of punishment. And the prophets, and perhaps God learns, that punishing has its limitations. And Jeremiah knows this. When punishment no longer works, then you must speak only, and can only speak, about a radically new beginning. And our whole language of the Christian faith comes out of that experience and realize that chastisement and punishment are futile. And if we read this, and some of you don't have, what's this book by Jack Miles, God and Autobiography? You know, it sort of portrays God as a character in sort of literature and drama here that sort of struggles to learn, and God's a slow learner, and you sort of read back from that rather imaginatively, and I mean, Lutherans probably don't find very comfortable doing this, most of us, and that, but you know, to portray the God is from the sort of struggle. And that the danger when you speak about the heart of God and the inwardness of God and the feelings of God, and God not just doing sort of pronouncements, you know, God's not that stable sort of rock. God is, whatever we else would say, is something like us. The parent, the lover, we all know disappointment. And because you have known human experience, you can begin to experience the pain of God. The message. And I want to, because chapter 6, verse 1-6 is quoted by Jesus directly twice on that, and that's very much on his consciousness on that message. It says, little prediction, and the kinds of prediction are that there, they're not cast in that form, don't ring true. He's taking God's side of the controversy. I've already hinted at the theme here, common in all prophets. But for the first time, as well as I know, the covenant is referred to in the language, in the experience of marriage. God has bound us together, like human beings are bound together in the vows and the compassion and the commitment of marriage. We talked about the understanding of sin. A whole other theme is healing that we haven't touched upon. But the primary thing that is here that Heschel suggests, and I think he is right, that Hosea, more than any of the prophets, until we come to Jeremiah, and we Christians would add Jesus, unveils for us the heart of God, the inwardness of God. And two terms lift up that that power that are in chapter 6, verse 1-6. The first one is the term in Hebrew. I've never learned to say that because the Hebrew language is two hard H's that are guttural in sound and, you know, harsher than our H's. Our H's is soft and chesed on that. I'll just say hesed on that. And biblical translators in the English have had trouble translating it because there's no concept like that in the English language. There is no word. Those who translated the King James Bible coined a word, loving kindness. In the RSV, New RSV, it is steadfast love. In the American Bible Society Good News Bible, it is constant love, and many other things. And typically, we need two terms or a coin term here. And Heschel has the expression here, and we can get it from the text, two elements that are closely bound together, affection, attachment, that are there, and lastingness. And steadfast love is the quality both of God, very clearly. God is steadfast and passionate and affectionate, but human beings are invited. In fact, that's the fundamental invitation for human beings and the people of Israel to have that affectionate passion that lasts. And typical of prophetic language, they always use sort of parallel sorts of phrases, and like Amos's righteousness and justice, the justice and righteousness, here is steadfast love and the knowledge of God. These two terms together are talking about what God desires. That marvelous passage in chapter 6:6. Knowledge of God means, Heschel suggests in the Hebrew language, attachment, intimacy. It's very close to that. But to note in the Hebrew language, the term da'ah, or the term yada, the verb on that, refers to sexual intercourse. Adam knows Eve. He has intercourse with Eve, and she bears a child. And is used in many levels, and you have to pay attention to the context, and those overtones are always there. And so it is a language of deep personal intimacy that is there, that is appropriate for marriage and husband and wife. But the other side of it, if you listen to the indictment that was there, sin is forgetting and losing that knowledge. And because you forget, from that flows deceit and violence, injustice, unrighteousness. The common ones, the person in the morning commentator or the other class indicate that Abraham decides the act described, or Abraham, Amos describes the actions, but Hosea goes to the root of the problem. Because you have forgotten the land and even the soil and the birds and animals are strewn with violence. And that's the situation in which you find yourself. This is what I desire. Let me take two other passages and we can pick some things up on that. I decided after I did this morning session to take up chapter 11, but first let me sort of connect this directly with the New Testament, if you have that handy. Matthew 9:13, and he said, there are a number of allusions in Jesus' language, and this one is very direct. And chapter 9, Jesus is associating with the wrong kind of people. And the Pharisees, you're eating with tax collectors and sinners. But what does he tell the Pharisees? Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. For I came not to call the righteous and sinners. I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice. If you would have understood the message of the prophet Hosea, you would not have objected here for my eating with tax collectors and sinners, prostitutes among them. And then 12, the same sort of reference, and that 12 verse 7. And this is the context in the violation of the Sabbath, and it refers to the story of David here for a higher purpose, sort of violating the Sabbath laws, and this sort of counters the legalism that the Pharisees had. And the very end of that, and if you had known what this means, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Jesus applies this. Applies in some or other ways. The relationship of God here is not in terms of sacrifice or in that kind of worship. It is really much else. I desire that steadfast love and that deep knowledge of God. That other phrase is not in the Jesus words, but I'm sure the understanding is there. But then to turn back to chapter 11, that I would like to add, because the image that we have in the experience is that of the dumb lover. It is the male, we understand this in the language of the term of the time, of the prerogatives of the male and the marriage at that time, because if you have a woman who is publicly unfaithful, not only your feeling, but the law requires you to dispose of her, to get rid of her. You have the right as the male. And she has no right in your household or with your children. She is to be disposed of. And all of a sudden he says that God commands him to violate both, you know, the Mosaic law and custom. Take back that boring wife of yours. And he's got to woo her. I mean, she's not going to come back willingly. And that sort of thing that. But there's another image. In chapter 11, and let me read this several passages. I can read it in the light here. And this is interesting because listen to this. Years ago, before the feminist movement gained a lot of thing, I always translated this in terms of the parent and not the father. And somebody announced in the earlier class that this has the feelings and the experience of the mother behind it. At least those would normally be attached here, so the caring and compassion would be there. It could be a male, because people often say Jesus is a male, but he has all the feminine characteristics going on in our culture. And Jose may have it at all, but we'll do this before. Not quite 10 yet, so we'll go there. When Israel was a child, again, God speaking in the first person, I loved him. And out of Egypt I called my son. By the way, the Gospel of Matthew refers to this as a symbolic or allegorical reference. The more I called them or him, the more they went from me. They kept sacrificing to the Baal, you know, the Lord's the fertility power, and burning incense to idols. Yet it was I, you know, the language of the mother, or of a good father, who taught Ephraim to walk. I took him up in my arms, but he did not know that I healed him. I led him with cords of compassion, a marvelous phrase, and with bands of love, the training of a child and what sort of motivates it. And then to pick up the theme again on verse 8. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can you hand her over, O Israel? I mean, the prophet is aware of the destruction that's at the edge and almost certainly come. How can I make you like Adamah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? You know, I think two cities that were destroyed in their own lifetime. My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not man, the Holy One in your midst, and I come not to destroy. A painful passage. I am God and not man. Again, like many prophets, God repents and changes his mind. And that leads us into the heart of God, which is essentially, we know that God and he feels pain, but out of that pain, he's willing to forgive again and again. That God has a love that will not let us go, as our hymn says in that. But then to put that against the reality, shortly after these words were spoken, Israel was totally destroyed. Can we remember both that compassionate love of God and the reality of the world that has both? Hosea leads us this, and I tell students, and you brought about earlier, I come to that, and it comes to prediction, if Hosea is a book of predictive prophecy, Hosea strikes out. It is a book here that opens up in a powerful way what God is like and what God desires us to be. Heschel 300, or Heschel, I should say Hosea. I always make Heschel Hosea up because I feel that he feels himself into Heschel, or into Hosea in a very powerful way. And sometime at your leisure, study this and listen to the echoes of Hosea and what Jesus does and what Jesus says. You'll find an amazing connection. Thanks. Thank you.